Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Tristan and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 172 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell, and alongside me, Johnny Stofko.
What's up, Tristan Cannell? What's up, everybody? Episode 172. It's been an honor this whole time. As this is going to air, it's going to be post-birthday, but I just want to let you know, happy birthday, Tristan.
Oh, thanks, man. Appreciate that, brother.
Yeah, man. Getting young as I've ever seen you.
35, man.
Guys, go to his Facebook and look at the video of him throwing hands. He doesn't look 35. Got them hand speed popping.
Garth Wood was making me look good.
Yeah, he made a lot of people look bad. So if he's making you look good, that's a good thing.
He's a good trainer.
He's a hell of a fighter, too.
Yeah, he's a very good fighter. It was just on my birthday. He put me through a session with mates. So, yeah, shout out to Garth. You know, he's a good dude. So
yeah, man, we're cheering for him. Who we got? 172.
Man, it's a great episode. Dominic D'Agostino, one of the really big leaders in our industry at the moment, someone that's really highly regarded, well sought after, doing his thing in the keto world.
Transcending the industry, you know, we're going to touch base on a lot of different topics here. His work with NASA, you know, you guys listen to our show, you probably saw him on Joe Rogan. He's this guy who's, you know, not that old, researching, pushing the industry forward, and with the intentions of helping people. I think that's really important.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things that, you know, it's not mainstream yet. It's one of those things that hopefully it does and more research comes out. I think it's had a lot of success with things that we've spoken about before with epilepsy and some forms of cancer.
Inflammation, seizures.
Yeah. Anything that can help people live a longer and more prolonged life, I guess, is something that, for me, it's something that should be brought out there.
So important. And I think that in the industry, you know, like the fitness industry, guys, the fitness industry, coming from two coaches' perspective, it could be really catty. It could be really opinionated, but when you have a gentleman, I think the word diet, I think, you know, because Dom does so much more than just the, you know, research on ketosis. The guy is in a couple different things pushing the human race forward. But I think whenever you put the word diet on the end of anything, coaches or the average person kind of jumps to either one, they jump on board, or two, they're like, oh, the keto diet. It's like, guys, ketosis is a state of a body's regulatory system of like using fats as energy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know some guys, some colleagues of ours who are like, oh, they hear keto diet. They're instantly, without any research, they just go, oh, what is that? Is he a guru?
Yeah. And I think for me, it's, you know, why wouldn't we want to kind of try it for ourselves before we try to knock something? And with the world being, you know, you can get boring eating the same things day after day after day. If it's going to help us in some sort of way, even just trying it for a few months, I think, at least for your own state of mind, to see whether it works or not for yourself, because we all have different bodies. But I would probably give it a go. I've seen it work for my brother. He's lost about 30 kilos on it. So big shout out to him.
Mark Cannell in the house.
To doing that. And like I said, like, I don't have 30 kilos to lose, but who knows? It might help me with brain function, or who knows where the track's going to go. Hopefully I don't get any diseases that we spoke about before, but who knows?
And I think that's the biggest point here is evolving, progressing ourselves, one, individually as people, and then wanting our community to evolve in a positive manner. And you see that with, you know, the evolution of, like you said, why wouldn't you want to, if things aren't working out, or if you feel that there's a benefit or a bonus in trying something new, why wouldn't you want to do that? For instance, our show, this is 172. This went from you and I talking to each other to our obsession or our love affair with our combat athletes and our fighters. We would fanboy some of them. And now, talking to these experts and research and doctors and PhDs, that's a sign of you and I evolving, because these have turned into my favorite conversations. Mm. Talking to these high-level educated researchers who are pushing the, you know, the envelope forward.
Yeah, it's about putting your hand up and just saying, well, I don't know anything about this really.
There it is. I don't know anything.
Yeah.
I can barely speak.
Being open, being open to kind
I'm
of
I'm like a
learning.
Mollusk. I'm just sitting here like, not even a single cell organism.
Guys, before we bring Dom on the show, just a big shout out for all the everyone subscribing to the show via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. If you haven't yet, please jump on, just search Vision Board Podcast. And if you can, please leave us a 5-star review.
Are we still on SoundCloud? I know this is kind of a hot topic
online lately. It's kind of just being phased away. So,
are we pushing them anywhere forward soon? Do we have anything?
If you're not on iTunes, the best way for an alternative, if you don't have Stitcher downloaded on your phone, because that is an app as well.
For audio, right? The Stitcher takes the...
Absolutely. Or the easiest way is always just jump on the website, www.thevisionboardpodcast.com. There will always be a player in the different, it's on the homepage as a player, and then in different show notes, which you can find in different sites, different pages on our site, you'll be able to find it. But if you ever have trouble, please send us an email at info@thevisionboardpodcast.com and we'll point you in the right direction.
Yeah, and this shout out to my boy, Coach Adam Carter, your boy, Dom D. We got him on, so hope you enjoy.
Enjoy, Adam. But for now, I present Dominic D'Agostino. All right, guys, our special guest is Dominic D'Agostino. Dominic is an assistant professor at the University of South Florida. He's a senior research scientist at the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition. Dom was recently a member of NASA NEMO 22 Project, and we're happy to have him on the podcast today. We welcome Dominic D'Agostino. Dom, welcome to the show, bud.
Thank you for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Dom, like Tristan aforementioned, your credentials speak for themselves, education, research, basically doing much as you can to push everything forward. From a health and, you know, wellness perspective, I wanted to open this chat up a little bit about, you know, simplifying for the people listening who maybe have never heard of a ketone or what a ketone is and maybe its function and role in the body.
Yeah, sure. So a ketone, I like to start off maybe in the context of not necessarily the diet, but what happens when your body gets into a state of ketosis, like on a normal scenario, which would be in the absence of food, you know, which we call an extreme, and an extreme would be starvation, but to a lesser extent and to a therapeutic, you know, benefits, we can do fasting. And with an overnight fast, you start to use up some of your stored sugar in the form of glycogen, and you start mobilizing fat for fuel. And the brain gets hungry, though, because it can't utilize these fats efficiently as an energy source. So the liver is really fine-tuned to be a metabolic sensor of your body, and it starts to break down these fats that we liberate from adipose into water-soluble, you know, breakdown products of fats. And these are ketone molecules, and they come primarily in the form of beta-hydroxybutyrate and acetoacetate. And they are small molecules, and unlike long-chain fats, they can cross the blood-brain barrier and energize your brain and keep your brain functioning efficiently, even in terms of or in periods of limited food availability or carbohydrate restriction. So the ketogenic diet can essentially do the same thing. It elevates these ketone bodies, which are energy metabolites that your tissues can use and your brain really can thrive off them. And the ketogenic diet can essentially accomplish the same thing as fasting. And metabolically, they're very similar, but also different in ways. And you can sustain ketosis on a ketogenic diet. You know, we can't sustain fasting for a long time, but it was observed that fasting could be very effective for managing seizures, and, you know, millennia ago. And in 1920s, the Mayo Clinic sort of figured out that, you know, we could maintain this state with a ketogenic diet. And we've advanced pretty far since then. I think it's an underutilized metabolic therapy, although it is the standard of care and getting a lot more attention, because the applications for nutritional ketosis have really exploded. I mean, when I got into it, it was, you know, 7 years ago, and it was pediatric epilepsy, and now there's like dozens of applications for the ketogenic diet with different levels of evidence, and some of it is proven, and some of it is emerging, and other evidence is more anecdotal, but the interesting thing is that it does have a lot of different applications, and that's kind of what I'm known for, is studying the main applications, which is seizure, but also all the emerging applications too. We do quite a bit of research on.
And Dom, on a personal level, was this something that you either struggled with or experienced on your intent on researching, you know, ketosis and the effects of you know, putting your body in that state? Did you struggle? Did you have seizures? Was this something that you wanted to educate yourself with?
In the past, just being kind of a fitness enthusiast and a lifter and dieting at different times in my life, I thought I followed a ketogenic diet, but I really didn't because I didn't really know what it was from a clinical standpoint.
Yeah.
But I was, as a postdoctoral fellow, when I completed my PhD, and when I transitioned to my postdoctoral fellowship, I was awarded a grant through the Office of Navy Research, which is part of the Department of Defense. And that was really to study oxygen toxicity seizures. And these are seizures that are a limitation for our special operations forces, especially the Navy SEALs that use a closed circuit rebreather. And sort of, you know, the research was directed to understanding why these occur. And later on, in subsequent grants, the research focus was to develop a mitigation strategy to prevent it. And anti-seizure drugs were kind of like the go-to option. And then in the process of researching what other anti-seizure strategies, I stumbled upon the ketogenic diet and saw quite convincingly, just, you know, off peer-reviewed studies, that it was very effective for epilepsy and seizures independent of the etiology, which means that, like, it controlled all sorts of seizures and different kinds of seizures. So I wanted to, the idea was to use it for our military personnel, special operations forces in particular, to make the safety and performance of the Navy SEAL better in that way. So, you know, we embarked on some studies in rodent models and rats and showed that we could, and there was some work done that was previously done with fasting, showing that it was remarkably effective. When you just 24 hours or 36 hours of fasting, you know, it was remarkably effective. And I put my effort into not necessarily the ketogenic diet, because that was not going to be embraced by the military at the time, because and they're starting to come around a little bit on that, but they really wanted a ketogenic diet and a pill per se. So I kind of put my efforts into, you know, developing various compounds that could be consumed orally as a supplement, and some of them are in the realm of what you would call, maybe a chemical entity would be in the realm of like a drug, and then there's various things that have developed and tested in the realm of supplements. So that's kind of been a big thrust of what we do, and exploring this idea of delivering a high-energy metabolic substrate to the brain that could essentially preserve brain energy metabolism and allow the brain to function in an extreme environment. Our lab is kind of built upon this idea of enhancing safety and performance in extreme environments. And in our lab, the Hyperbaric Biomedical Research Lab, or that part of the lab, we have these chambers that can essentially mimic a broad range of extreme environments, from the undersea environment to the top of Mount Everest to, you know, pulling a vacuum and kind of simulating a space environment too. So we use these technologies to really understand what's happening from the cellular, molecular, and physiological effect of that environment. And in the process of doing that, you know, it became apparent that in testing various strategies to enhance resilience, I would say, under extreme environments, we were looking at metabolic approaches. So it became apparent that if you could preserve normal brain energy metabolism and, say, the homeostasis of the brain, from a metabolic standpoint, you could preserve functioning under high pressures of oxygen, which cause oxidative stress. And we could see this in, like, for example, a cell culture model, like cells on a petri dish. So that observation and also the observation that the ketogenic diet was more effective for seizures than any anti-epileptic drug was kind of just gave me almost the no-brainer idea to use nutritional ketosis as a performance-enhancing strategy or a safety strategy too for special operations diving. The guys that are, you know, at risk for an oxygen toxicity seizure. And when special operations forces are using a closed circuit rebreather, they usually don't dive down very deep. It's pretty like shallow diving, except like in the event that they would have to evade the enemy for example, you know, a helicopter over and you can see them. So visibility such that they need to dive down farther or to plant a mine at 50 feet of seawater using this equipment, you are at risk of having a seizure. Yeah. So that is always of a concern. And so that's kind of the real world scenario where this could be a problem. And there's pulmonary oxygen toxicity too, which your lungs, high pressure oxygen can affect your lungs too. So we want to understand this problem and also develop ways to prevent it. So ketones, so just getting back to what a ketone is a high energy metabolic substrate. So think of like creatine, right? So we can consume creatine orally and it builds up in our tissues. And under high-intensity anaerobic training, it can help muscle cells regenerate ATP, and also the brain too. So ketones are kind of like creatine, right? So they're more versatile in ways because they can cross membranes easily. They can be used by the mitochondria, and they also have, in addition to helping the cells preserve ATP levels under extreme stress, they also have important signaling properties, and they impact gene expression, for example, and they have anti-inflammatory effects. So that's really like the thrust of what we're studying. We're studying how to enhance and make the brain function like it normally would in an extreme environment where it would literally be having a seizure or would start, you know, killing off brain cells. Yeah. So we are sort of, you know, creating those environments and studying various model systems and using kind of dose-dependent effects. And in the process of studying ketones, we are looking at their effects to the neuroprotective effects from toxins, from radiation, enhancing recovery, having anti-catabolic effects, so preserving the muscle and preventing it from breaking down, having anti-inflammatory effects. So we're looking at those things, and from the special operations community and the military community, they want to be able to enhance recovery and repair and prevent overtraining. So this is just kind of a broad breadth of what we do, and any of those things I could kind of describe in particular, kind of our approaches to studying that.
Yeah. Dom, you know, you explain, you know, really, really well why the advantages for a military person to use it. Also, I've read some studies about its advantages with people with epilepsy and also with cancer. Now, with someone just, for example, just a general pop, someone that is a corporate worker or maybe just has a general 9-to-5 job, is there any advantages of using the keto diet?
Yeah, so the ketogenic diet comes in all shapes and forms, and then there's ketone supplements too that can sort of be a way to further enhance, to augment the therapeutic effects and perhaps the performance-enhancing effects too. But from, you know, I take myself as an example, or the many people who contact me, like during the course of a week, many of them are CEO-type executives or athletes. When I started the ketogenic diet, I did the medical-based ketogenic diet that was primarily used, you know, by Johns Hopkins, and it was really high in fat, kind of lower in protein. But now I do a modified form of the ketogenic diet, which is more liberal in protein, so about 30% protein. On average, maybe about 10% carbohydrates, mostly from vegetables, so it's a little higher in carbohydrates than most ketogenic diets, and pretty high in a wide range of different types of fats. And following that diet, I am able to go longer on the course of a work day and maintain my focus, maintain my energy, and not get hungry. That's probably the biggest thing. So typically in the past, like maybe going back 10 years ago, I would stop, you know, multiple times throughout the day, stop working, leave the facility if I was doing animal research or whatever, and have to go prepare food, eat food, clean up, and then go back. Yeah. So it has made me much more productive, and in the process of the work day, I kind of have more sustained energy. Like if it's a day that I'm doing intermittent fasting, which I do once or twice a week, I'll get a little bit hungry, but I can kind of power through it. And even, you know, towards the end of my intermittent fasting kind of day, I will kind of feel better than I normally would have been, even if I ate breakfast that morning, you know, kind of once I power through it. And the more you follow the ketogenic diet, the easier it gets, because there's quite a learning curve. And there's also a period where your body is literally kind of metabolically adapting to burning fats and ketones for fuel more efficiently. So from an enzymatic, you're upregulating, you know, ketolytic enzymes, fat oxidation enzymes, your liver's kind of, you know, adjusting to digesting, assimilating and fat and making more ketones from fat. And also you're upregulating, and this has been shown, you know, pretty clear in animal models, that you significantly upregulate the various proteins that are part of the ketone transporters. So you're transporting more of the ketones across the membrane, so your brain and other tissues can be using them as fuel. So it doesn't happen in a week, and it happens, you know, over the course of weeks to months, and maybe even, you know, many months, or maybe even, I think people have been, you know, following a ketogenic diet for a year can get benefits even after a year of following it.
Dom, a buddy of mine is a former Navy diver here in Sydney, Australia, and he, a few years back, he went up to Florida to see you speak, and he always brings you up, and he always, I don't want to say sells me or pitches me, but he always talks and tries to educate me on exogenous ketones, and like, they come in like supplement forms. I've never taken them. I see a lot of the coaches in small groups that I'm part of online pitching them. Is this in the same realm of, are those two connected, taking it as a supplement and then putting your body naturally in a state of ketosis? Are those in the same, like, are those connected?
Yeah, they're connected with the idea that you are elevating your ketone levels. And if you were to use a device and do blood work and measure your levels after you've taken exogenous ketones, they're bioidentical. So it would look like you have fasted or are on a ketogenic diet. And there are benefits to ketone supplementation that are similar to benefits with a ketogenic diet or maybe even short-term fasting. And there's definitely benefits to each one has its own effect, but there's many overlapping effects from fasting ketosis, ketogenic diet, and exogenous ketone supplementation. And, you know, the one effect that I'm interested in from a research point of view is anti-seizure effects and neuroprotection. Mm. And also supplying the brain energy. If you keep your brain happy with a uninterrupted high intensity or high efficiency fuel source, it tends to, you know, not only enhance and preserve cognitive performance, but also, you know, your brain makes your muscles fire. You know, it's the driving force for, you know, skeletal muscle activation. So preserving your CNS is really important for athletic performance and preservation of that performance in extreme environments. So I think there's some benefits there. And I think maybe that's where exogenous ketones may shine, because it's really easy to kick yourself out of fasting ketosis. It's very easy to kick yourself out of the ketogenic diet ketosis. So exogenous ketones can be delivered very precisely to put you into a dose-dependent state of nutritional ketosis that can be titrated depending upon what the application is and personalizing it to yourself. Like some people, you know, me personally, I feel better at about 1 to 1.5 millimolar of ketones under normal situations, where other people may be a little bit different. So we can, when people are using these things and we're testing it in various animal models, we can determine what would be the optimal sort of metabolomic profile that would enhance neuroprotection or performance resilience in that particular model. And that can be, to some extent, extrapolated to humans. It might not be the same dosage, but we know we need to get a little bit higher if we want to protect from this or want performance enhancement on that. Mm-hmm. So these tools are becoming available. And it's kind of interesting that there's commercially available tools that can allow us to prick our finger and measure with a blood drop the levels of these things in our blood. And that's pretty cool. Like, if, because there's no drugs, there's, you know, anti-epileptic drugs out there, but there's no way to, like, prick your finger and test it and know that you're in the optimal, pharmacological range for that to be working, whereas these tools exist that allow us to do that. And I know people are working on continuous monitors like they'd have with glucose monitors that can actually measure, you know, glucose, ketones, and lactate and all these things. So we get kind of an overall metabolic profile of what.
What's up, guys? Be sure to pick up your free copy of Conversations with Champions. This is our free ebook, which is comprised of inspirational quotes from past guests that we've had on the show.
Get inspirational quotes from champions such as Evander Holyfield, Jonathan Thurston, Grant Cardone, Gary Vee, Larry Holmes, Mario Andretti, Anthony Mundine, Joe DeFranco, and many, many more.
To pick up your free copy now, just simply go to our website, divisionboardpodcast.com/ebook. Put your name and email in the slot. It takes about 10 seconds, and we'll send you the book directly to your inbox. Now back to the show.
Dom, in America, what's the feeling like within the medical community? Are you getting much support in terms of, you know, when someone gets diagnosed for a certain disease, let's just say cancer? Are GPs or specialists, are they recommending this form of diet?
Very rapidly, actually. And, you know, I think most importantly, what needs to happen is large-scale clinical trials with multiple institutions involved. So there's a lot of pilot trials that have been done and anecdotal reports and a number of case studies that suggest that diet could be effective perhaps on its own when the standard care fails. But from my perspective, the ketogenic diet, when it comes to cancer at least, has the greatest application when it's used as an adjuvant for other forms of therapy. So that could be the standard of care therapy for some types of cancers or, you know, other types of metabolic-based therapies or immune therapies that are coming out. But there's definitely more support for it. I have a conference coming up the week after next where I'll be talking to a couple hundred medical doctors about this who are very interested in this and signed up for it because many of these integrative doctors are already using it in their practice. But the large academic institutions have not yet fully embraced this into large-scale clinical trials. I should say, when I started doing this research, there were like no clinical trials registered on clinicaltrials.gov, and now there's over a dozen. So they're definitely there's definitely a big interest in it and more clinical trials starting. The Moffitt Cancer Center, which is a tier one, you know, cancer center adjacent to our university, has reached out to us, and we worked with them to actually write a National Institutes of Health, an NIH, and National Cancer Institute grant, which is a very large grant. It's what's called an R01 grant. So this has been submitted, and the idea behind this grant is to use nutritional ketosis, a diet, and also in combination with a supplement for low-grade gliomas. So, and to track, you know, and monitor the patient's progression or remission as they follow this diet. So that's under review now, and we're hoping that we can start, you know, a larger clinical trial that's NIH funded. And that's really needs to be the goal here is to first evaluate nutritional therapy as it would be to enhance the standard of care.
So correct me if I'm wrong, is the goal of putting ourselves, the individual, in a state of ketosis at its most simple level to use our fats as energy, as an energy source? Is that the goal?
It depends on, you know, where you're coming, what your goal is. So the goal for someone with seizures would be to probably get into a state of nutritional ketosis and to get ketones elevated because we know that has in and of itself an anti-seizure effect. Okay. I think for most normal people, you know, following the average, you know, everyday person who's kind of embracing this idea for ketosis, yeah, it would be to mobilize fat for energy and to leverage sort of all the benefits that's involved with that, which would be suppression of the hormone insulin, to some extent a lowering, mobilizing fat for fuel, making ketones, you know, the anti-inflammatory effects, the potential longevity effects too. Folks that are older and that maybe have, you know, signs of that are a little overweight, that are kind of pushing type 2 diabetes or that have overt type 2 diabetes, are usually really good responders to the ketogenic diet. It is kind of interesting that it seems like the group that has the most intense interest in the ketogenic diet are kind of guys that are already athletically fit and maybe not guys that would be sort of, you know, would benefit tremendously from the ketogenic diet. I think there are a lot of benefits from the ketogenic diet, but I think the people, sort of the low-hanging fruit, if you will, would be people that have, you know, overt type 2 diabetes, obesity, inflammation, you know, age-related chronic diseases that kind of creep up on us when we get in our 50s and 60s. These people will respond very dramatically. And even athletes who maybe are looking for an edge in a different way, make their bodies a little bit more fat adapted, can also benefit from it. But from my perspective and from a military perspective or even a NASA perspective, the benefits would be not entirely, you know, performance, but it would be performance resilience, I guess you would say, and that there's some logistical sort of practical benefits too of the ketogenic diet. You know, you don't get hungry. So in the face of limited food availability, you know, you could preserve that performance. If you couldn't eat, for example, you're a little bit better adapted there. If you fats are 9 calories per gram as opposed to, you know, 4 calories for carbohydrates and proteins. So if you are dropped off at a location with 5 or 6 days of food and you're eating a ketogenic macronutrient profile, you're handling a lot less weight and a lot less space too. So the amount of food that you're carrying, the volume would be less. So these are like very practical logistical things that the military and NASA will kind of look at as big pluses.
Dom, I heard you speak prior about the Inuits and how culturally it's like how they survive and how they've lived for, you know, forever. Are there any other examples overall as a culture of, you know, maybe it's because of the topography of where the people live geographically, but like culturally, is the collective people taken on that and then shown signs of the, you know, the positive long-term effects of being in a state of ketosis with survival?
Yeah, I think if you go back and just our species in general, probably definitely thrived off a lower carbohydrate diet. You know, some of the books, kind of looking back over my shoulder at the different books that I read on the human diet, the evolution of the human diet, showed that, you know, we ate a lot of fiber. In some cases, you know, 150, 200 grams of fiber, I've read in some of the books, depending on the location. And more northern climates, obviously, especially, you know, during the winter, there would be a very carbohydrate restricted, more just high protein, higher fat. Like the Inuits and some populations we know, like Native Americans and Inuits, when they are exposed to a diet that's rich in carbohydrates and doesn't even have to be processed carbohydrates, they quickly, you know, get type 2 diabetes and become obese over time. So they tend to be very responsive to carbohydrate restriction, and it doesn't have to be a ketogenic diet. There are benefits to elevating ketones, but I think what needs to be clear is that a lot of people out there will benefit simply from carbohydrate restriction, whereas some people thrive off a high carb. My wife, actually, she does really well. She she eats a higher carbohydrate diet just by choice and does really well. You know, I don't know if that'll continue to go on as you know over the years, but particularly younger people, you know, when I played football, I can't imagine eating a ketogenic diet at that time. It would have been an interesting experiment to do, but as we age, there's no doubt that we can't, our carbohydrate tolerance decreases with age. Mm-hmm. And it's not a completely a thing where we're just reducing our activity. I mean, we metabolically, you know, our carbohydrate tolerance will decrease over time. So people that are a little bit older tend to thrive on a ketogenic diet when they transition.
Yeah. Dom, in your research, or maybe some of the research by your colleagues, have you come across anything in regards to brain trauma towards combat athletes or even footballers, or even in regards to things like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's?
Yeah, that's another really interesting area of research for a metabolic intervention. And there needs to be a lot more research in that area to get a clear understanding of the therapeutic potential of nutrition or metabolic interventions, or ketones in particular. We do know that with Alzheimer's disease, one of the best ways to kind of characterize it, and this would also apply to traumatic brain injury, you can kind of think of traumatic brain injury as like Alzheimer's disease in real time, if we're speaking from a metabolic perspective. Because if you use various imaging technologies that can assess the metabolic state of the organ, the brain, a fluorodeoxyglucose PET scan, an FDG PET scan, it will be considerably less intensity in fluorescence when we image an Alzheimer's patient, and also when we image a person who have had, especially multiple concussions or brain injury. And from a perspective of reducing, you know, subsequent injury in the brain and getting the brain to function, the best thing that we could do is restore normal brain energy metabolism. And a way to do that would be to fuel the brain with ketones. And by doing that, when there is brain injury, and interestingly, also in the case of Alzheimer's disease, where you have amyloid and tau plaques, you have two things, you have many things going on, but two things, metabolically speaking, would be a lower amount of pyruvate dehydrogenase complex and a reduced activity of PDH complex, and an internalization of the glucose transporter. In neurons, that would be the GLUT3 transporter. So these two things, and there's a number of other things that could be discussed, but these two things impair glucose utilization in the brain. And so the brain's kind of like shutting down. And when it does that, a number of things happen, including the brain cannot defend itself against oxidative stress, against inflammation and things like that. Supplying ketones can literally bypass pyruvate dehydrogenase complex and literally bypass the absence of the GLUT3 transporter. And these are transported independently of glucose through the MCT transporter, monocarboxylic acid transporter, not to be confused with MCT oil. And that allows, and this transport of ketones into the brain allows it to quickly restore normal brain energy metabolism, and it also has an anti-inflammatory effect. So if we reduce inflammation, especially during quickly after the brain injury, there's a lot of potential therapeutic effects you could have long term. So I see from a scientific perspective, the scientific rationale is pretty clear that it can help. And work done by a number of groups suggests that the benefits of ketosis would be much greater in younger people than it would be in an adult population. Not that it wouldn't have, you know, a therapeutic effect in an adult population, but that, and it makes sense because younger brains are more plastic and more resilient, but they are also more responsive to the therapeutic effects following brain injury.
Dom, in the last year and a half, I made some, you know, small changes in my own personal nutrition, raised Italian. I used to consume a lot of pastas, breads, and turning 35 in April, it's been about a year and a half since I haven't canceled out total carbs, and I don't track my calories, but I lost 12 kilos and I sit about 9% body fat, 5'11". I wanted to ask you, because I tell a lot of my clients too, for me personally, when I do eat like a meal of just a lot of high carbs, I feel really lethargic after. It's almost like that quote unquote food coma. After the changes that I've made, and I really focus more on the fats and proteins without measuring it, is there any way, is there something out there, some test that if I wanted to, I could see if I am in a state of ketosis, some over-the-counter sort of product I could buy?
Yeah, the easiest way to do it would probably be just to get urine ketone strips. And you can get them, well, in the United States, I would think in over there in Australia,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, my brother's got
them. Urine ketone sticks. Get those, and they measure acetoacetate. And I'm trying to look. So another tool that you could use, which is probably a little better, it's called MultiStick, Siemens MultiStick SG. And it measures not only urinary ketones, but it measures like leukocytes and nitrates, and it measures markers of kidney function. It measures glucose levels too, relative changes. So urine ketone strips would be kind of my first thing, and that would tell you if you're in a relatively speaking, whether you're in or not in ketosis. And if you want a higher granularity, the gold standard would be to measure your blood ketones, and that can be done with various meters on the market. Keto Mojo is one of them. I think I have a link on my ketonutrition.org website. Mm-hmm. That's a new meter that came out. It's cheaper. And then the more expensive one, which is the one we have most experience with just because it's been around for a long time, is the Abbott Labs Precision Extra. And you can buy this on Amazon. You can buy it most places. And you can buy glucose and ketone strips that go into the meter. And in a single drop of blood, you could measure both your glucose levels and your ketone levels. And that'll be an objective kind of biomarker and indication of the level, if you're in ketosis or not, and what level you're in.
Thanks for that.
Yeah. Now, Dom, sure. Can I get an insight into maybe a couple of days of how you eat? Because I'm going to put some hate on you, man, because 2 years ago I heard you on Tim Ferriss, and then I stocked up on a hell of a lot of sardines and canned oysters, and I tried them, and it killed me, man. But
you're fancy, that's why.
Yeah, I was too fancy.
Dude, the oysters are off the hook.
So can I just get a little bit of insight onto how you do your thing, man?
Yeah, so everybody's going to do, you know, approaches differently depending on what foods they like. You know, my choice of foods, you know, are kind of unique, I guess, maybe. So this morning I had eggs, and my wife is like, she's from Europe, so she's a big fan of organ meats and pate.
Okay.
Yep. And like super fat, super high fat stuff.
What are you cooking, Dom? Also,
what's that?
What are you cooking? Butter?
Oh, what do I cook it in? Yeah. So I'll take the eggs and I'll give the whites to my dog, to my puppies. They're growing, so I'll mix it in with their food. And I give them ground beef and some other stuff like broccoli and things. And then I throw the eggs in a pan with coconut oil. And then I'll make like an egg yolk omelet, and then I'll put and I have asparagus. I'll throw on top of that. I'll chop it up and throw it in it. And you know, I don't eat a lot, but it's kind of a heavy breakfast. Although it's not like a big plateful because you know fat's pretty dense. And then I had that and a couple pieces of like this pate stuff that my wife gets. It's real expensive, but it's really good. So. And if I did, I've done the macros on that and I've calculated it, and it's literally about 70% fat, 65 or 70% fat, and like 30% protein, with the balance being, you know, just a minimal amount of carbohydrates from the asparagus. And then I have coffee, like black coffee sometimes, or I put Quest Nutrition makes an MCT oil powder. Or coconut oil powder, and I'll put one or two scoops in that. Mm-hmm. And kind of zip that up with a pinch of stevia, and that'll be my breakfast. That's like a normal breakfast. And for dinner, we eat, depending on like my goals, sometimes I'm trying to gain a little bit of weight, or sometimes I'm losing it, depending on my goals. But we eat a lot of chicken and beef, and probably more than anything else, fish. So we eat a ton of fish. Yep. I always make a salad, and we always have like cauliflower mashed potatoes where you cook it and like grind it up with butter until it's like creamy, yeah. and you make it like tastes like mashed potatoes actually. Wow. And we eat a lot of asparagus and broccoli and cabbage and Brussels sprouts and that sort of thing.
I'm glad you brought the I was going to say off air, I was talking before we got you on, I was talking to Tristan about, I love dogs, right? And I'm glad you brought the dog thing up, the animal aspect. You've highlighted the importance of focusing like high quality foods for the dogs as well, right? Not just humans, specifically putting them in a state of ketosis.
Yeah, absolutely. So we work very closely with the Keto Pet Sanctuary, and that's a facility maintained by the Epigenics Foundation. Okay. And, you know, my former PhD student works for them, and they actually rescue dogs that are in kill shelters and they that have cancer that would otherwise be put down. And they put them on a pretty strict, like, raw foods, ketogenic diet. And depending on the type of cancer they have, they may use other drugs, even standard of care drugs. But generally, the big therapy is the raw foods ketogenic diet that's carefully measured out. And it brings their glucose down typically, you know, from the low 100s down to like 50 or 60.
Wow.
So that's the big thing they do. They monitor the diet and they bring glucose way down and they get their ketones up. And it has a remarkably, you know, a huge effect at restoring their overall health, on wound healing. Like if the dogs have to have surgery to remove a tumor or something, they heal up very quickly. Wow. In some cases, they combine it with hyperbaric oxygen therapy and various, you know, metabolic drugs like metformin and even exogenous ketones are used in some of that. But yeah, I'm a big believer in like giving dogs human food of high quality. And if you go out and source it, and we'll go to a butcher and we'll buy like, you know, the bones, the femur bones, we'll buy lots of ground beef and organ meats and things like that. And we'll prepare the food for our dogs. And it's kind of a combination of, you know, fatty meats we use and various, we do throw in some greens. I even put like, I'm testing a product now with spirulina I'll put in it, but I'll mix up, you know, various, maybe it's like 10%, you know, green vegetables and basically just protein and fat. And we give it in small amounts. Like one of the dogs that we have is a lab, so they tend to overeat. And we, so we regulate his food to make sure that he's not like a typical lab and is kind of like overeating. And we have also a Great Dane, and these are two, wow, they're pretty high energy dogs. Mm. And one just had a surgery because he's so high energy, like he popped his ACL, what would be, or cruciate ligament, and got a repair on that. And he like healed up dramatically. You can't even see the scar on the inside of his legs. He completely healed up from that. But yeah, we're really big with pets. We do, my wife does a lot with foundation, and both of our dogs are rescues. So we're really big about, you know, pet nutrition, and that most of the food, at least here in the United States, that's fed to dogs really shouldn't be fed to dogs.
Yeah. For our Americans listening to this, could you kind of give that website or that info again for the rescue shelter place?
Yeah, sure. That's Keto Pet Sanctuary. Awesome. And it's all one word, K-E-T-O-P-E-T, Sanctuary. And on the front page of Keto Pet Sanctuary website, there's an ebook that you can download, and it's completely free. You download the ebook, and it tells you step-by-step how to make the optimal sort of diet for your dogs. And you can kind of, you know, take an hour or two out of your day and go buy the food, you know, buy it bulk at from a store and kind of mix it up and then like pre-package it and put it in your refrigerator. So it kind of makes feeding your dog pretty easy throughout the week. And your dog will thank you for it because they love, you know, obviously dogs love human food more than their like kibble or other kinds of food, right? And you can just look at their activity levels. I mean, the Keto Pet Sanctuary, you know, does blood work, so you can see objective biomarkers of their health you know, improve significantly. But you're doing your dog a big favor if you really pay attention to the food that's eating.
Yeah, Dom, are they living significantly longer?
Yeah, so, well, you know, dogs that have certain types of cancers can succumb to the tumors pretty fast. So it really does, there is a little bit of variability depending on how sick the dog is when it comes in. And, of course, you know, some cancers are fast moving, so they lose some of their dogs. But other dogs, you know, I guess maybe an example, the first dog that came in was Callie. And maybe I think her story might be on like the front page of the Keto Pet Sanctuary website, where she had pretty advanced metastatic cancer throughout her body. And after they followed the ketogenic diet, you know, raw foods, ketogenic diet protocol, where it was also calorie restricted, and they used some supplements on top of hyperbaric oxygen therapy, they were able to do PET scans from the beginning, intermediate phase, and towards the end to show that she was cancer-free. And she went on, she kind of sort of graduated from the program, and then now she's, you know, adopted by a family. Cool. That is taking care of her. And that doesn't happen with every dog, but that dog would be 100%, you know, fatality, that level of cancer that dog had. So they have a pretty high success rate of dogs coming through the program. And the idea is to not use, you know, drugs if you can, and just stick to more non-toxic approaches, with the foundation approach being a raw foods ketogenic diet that's also calorie restricted, because that's really important for dogs, because obviously dogs will just keep eating. You have to monitor and regulate the food to be able to hit the biomarkers that are necessary to get the therapeutic effects of the diet, which basically means, you know, the dogs are very well, have a high degree of nutrition coming into them, but a relatively low amount of calories. And that allows the glucose levels to come down into what we call the metabolic zone, the metabolic range, and the ketone levels that come up. In some cases, the ketone levels come up to about the same level of glucose. And when a dog can maintain that state, that first and foremost pretty much, you know, takes your foot off the gas pedal of cancer growth, right? It really slows down cancer growth, and it makes the dog more receptive and more responsive to other forms of modalities that you add on top of that.
Yeah, some interesting stuff for pet owners for sure. Now, Dom, final topic I want to chat to you about. I was just really intrigued about the recent work that you've done with NASA. Can you just give us some insights into your work there?
Yeah, sure. That's probably the most greatest experience of my life, I think, is working with NASA and actually being a crew member on the NASA Extreme Environment Mission Operations. And the acronym for that is NEMO. N-E-E-M-O, and I was a crew member for the NASA NEMO 22 mission, and this mission is under the water. It's not in space.
Okay.
NASA trains their astronauts in a huge pool at NASA called the Neutrobuoyancy Lab.
Yep.
And so if they, for example, have to do an extravehicular activity and go outside the space station to do stuff, they will train in the Neutral Buoyancy Lab, which is a huge pool that has a mock-up of the space station, and they will train and do that particular procedure about 7 times before they actually go up in space and do it. So you get to see them, you know, training in there. I actually did my swim test and some of my training in the Neutral Buoyancy Lab in preparation for a project that we did. It was a deep space project, or a Mars analog project. The idea is to have a crew of astronauts, and we had a planetary biologist on there that worked for NASA, and I was the scientist that was actually not a NASA employee. I was, you know, the scientist from the outside studying these guys. And we do quite a bit of training and quite a bit of preparation. We had 4 IRB protocols of research, like ethics reviewed research protocols on the NASA NEMO 2022 mission. And we're living under the sea in a state of saturation. which means when you're doing recreational scuba diving, you go down for a certain point of time and reach your no decompression limits, right? And you come back up, because otherwise your body gets saturated with nitrogen. And if you stay down there for too long and shoot up to the surface, you're going to die when you get to the surface. Wow. You'll die of something called decompression illness.
Yeah. Jeez.
Right?
Wow.
So for this project, we stayed underwater for, you know, more than 10 days, right? So we were living in what's called a state of saturation. And prior to like 1960, 62, like it was thought that humans couldn't necessarily live in saturation. So it is an extreme environment, and we're basically living at 3 atmospheres. So, you know, at sea level, which you guys are probably at, you're at 1 atmosphere of pressure. So we lived in an atmosphere that was about 3 atmospheres of pressure. Wow. Of air. And we would live in that. We lived in a dry habitat, which was, you know, when a submarine goes down underwater, they stay at 1 atmosphere. So the Aquarius habitat is actually, you know, you're staying at 3 atmospheres. So you're living, it's the same amount of pressure that if you went outside the habitat. And when you're inside what's about the size of an RV or a big camper with 6 guys living in there, and we would, we have a lot of the science experiments that we do on there, and that includes, we looked at like sleep, we did like gut microbiome, we did heart rate variability. We did exercises down there, and we had video cameras and software programs that would monitor our squat form and things like this. And we had a mini DNA analyzer that would basically look at the microbiome of our skin, of what microbes are living in the habitat, to make sure no, you know, bugs are mutating in this pressure environment that could, you know, potentially be pathological. In addition to the work that we did inside the habitat, part of the NASA mission is to test various engineering pieces of equipment outside in the water. So that would be called an extravehicular activity, or an EVA. And astronauts will do EVA when they go outside the space station. As aquanauts, when you're in saturation for more than 24 hours, you become an aquanaut. And as an aquanaut, we would go out into the environment, and we would do, like the European Space Agency had this equipment that would help us recover an injured astronaut and bring him back to. So we tested like that piece of equipment. There was the Coral Reef Project, where we would go out and we would identify and locate the, with precise coordinates, where certain endangered species of coral were. And we would collect the sample, and we would bring that sample back and grow it on a card. And then that card would go to a nursery where we would, where the Coral Reef Project's goal is to proliferate that endangered species of coral, so it can eventually become, you know, a coral nursery, like under the water. So we had, you know, probably 2 dozen different research objectives under there. And our lab was really focused on stress. So my wife is a cognitive behavioral neuroscientist, and she would test, you know, our reaction times and our thinking skills. And it was kind of intimidating, because she's comparing all my results to astronauts who are like off the scale smart and stuff. So it was a little bit intimidating from that. So she has all the, and I never really saw the scores of other people, but she's analyzing that data, which was pretty cool, because we would do the cognitive function tests, the reaction times, and the stress things inside the habitat, which would be a dry environment. And then we had these iPads that were set up to work underwater. And then we would take these iPads into the undersea environment, and there would be like reaction times where things would come across the screen and we would have to hit it, you know, with our fingers. So it would test the accuracy and the speed of our, and the crew was on a standard diet, which was basically the space-like food, which was like sort of like camping food. And I stayed in a state of nutritional ketosis throughout the whole thing. So I stayed on a ketogenic diet and also tested various ketone supplements in that state, and did some blood work beforehand. I collected blood work, you know, in the habitat at the end, and blood work after. And I'm looking at, for example, my stress hormones or my testosterone levels or just, you know, cardiometabolic parameters. So these are all data that we collected. And it's interesting to see kind of how my body's reacted to that extreme environment and also, you know, in regards to performance and sleep and all these different things, and then also how the other crew members reacted to that environment and determining whether, you know, being in a state of nutritional ketosis can help mitigate some of the negative effects that may occur in that environment.
Wow, what an absolute, that's unreal, man.
Yeah, like, man, thanks for sharing that with us.
That's an unreal situation to work for NASA.
Thanks for asking.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Yeah, there's so that happens every year, and every year they kind of select different people from NASA. They usually have a European Space Agency personnel come in, and we hope to also continue the research project that we started to do follow-up studies the same way, and basically do the same studies. So we'll have different groups of people looking at the same variable, so we can get a higher sample size, because we only got, you know, six guys down there. So we need to collect data as we move along, and for each of the missions. So that's, so it wasn't a one-time event. We hope to kind of be part of the future NASA NEMO missions too. Yeah.
Well, if you need some test subjects, man, try to pick our hand up.
Water terrifies me, Tris. How dare you throw me in
that? Dom, really appreciate you stopping by today. Before we let you leave, I want everyone following Dom. He's got a couple websites, www.ketonutrition.org, his blog, dominicdagostino.wordpress.com. Very active on his Twitter. It's Dominic, and then it's Dagosti2.
Yeah, Dom, thanks for stopping by. I wanted to, one more question. What, for guys like myself and people listening, where's the best, which one of those sites is the best one to study up on your research and keep up to date with what you're researching?
Yeah, I would go to, I haven't been on my blog for a while, actually, but my ketonutrition.org website, mm-hmm. If you go on there and click on resources, it's got, like, you know, all my podcasts, it's got books on there, like ebooks you can download, and all the supplements that I've kind of tested and vetted out. About 10 or 20% of those, a minority of those, kind of pass the test. And I put links to those, you know, recommended products, whether it be, KetoLogic food supplement, Ketogenics, ButcherBox meats. There's a ketogenic, a low-carb pizza that I really enjoy. It was my breakfast the last few days. I was using that. So some of the products on there and some of the information I think would be really helpful on there. So that would be ketonutrition.org. And I'm working on my newsletter. So I'm going to start shooting off a newsletter every couple weeks. And that'll have basically, you know, what product I tested, things I've been reading, kind of like, you know, what Tim Ferriss does with his Five Bullet Friday.
Yep.
Kind of I'm putting together a newsletter now with things that I think would be of interest to your listeners, and maybe as far as products and information.
Excellent, man. Once again, thanks again, Dom.
Thank you for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Johnny, that was the man, Dom D.
Once again, one of these gentlemen that we could just pretty much press record, press play, and listen to, because the guy has so many different levels, he's in it for the right reasons. You know this guy wants to help people.
Yeah, I'm not going to be eating no sardines and things. It's an interesting diet. Like,
Did you do the lemon juice and olive oil sardine can?
I've tried that before. Yes.
Yeah, those ones. Yes. Not for me, man.
Because I love oysters, like fresh.
Different animal when you put them in the can, though.
It killed it.
Yeah, different animal. It's literally tastes like a different animal.
Yeah.
In that can.
But it's got a different taste. Like, my mum loves it. She loves it on like a...
like a biscuit or wafer?
Like a biscuit or wafer. Yeah. And like put some pepper on it or something. And I'm going...
Yes, you're a fancy guy, though. You like the finer things. Fancy, you're going to be partying on a boat later. Like, you're a fancy guy. We need the oysters.
That's a bucks party, man. Yeah. We're not partying.
The boys.
I don't know what's going to go on there.
The oyster thing, I agree with you. Like, I thought I was risking enough just eating oysters a few years back just out of the shell raw.
Yeah.
And then I tried the can. No way. No, I can't eat them out of a can.
Different. Because you would have to think originally it was the exact same thing. And then once they put it in the can, it's just...
it changes the flavor profile.
I don't know what that was.
But listeners, guys, the health benefits of oysters are just astronomical. We touched base almost a year ago with Dr. Sean Stevenson, and he highlighted oysters as one of the if there were like the atypical diet that would be in there because of the high content of certain vitamins and iron and things like that for brain cognitive function.
Yeah. I'm glad I actually asked him about his breakfast. Sounds pretty yummy with the eggs and the
grains
and stuff.
How about the contrarian approach? I know he didn't do it to be the contrarian, but when most people throw the yolk away and use the whites, he gives the whites to his dog.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he uses the yolk's my favorite part. It's good to hear a guy who's educated on research with credentials. And if guys, you Google image him, he's a monster. Like, not saying that we have to go away from one or the other. Like, this is what works for him. You ask the question. And that breakfast, have you tried the multi-chain, like the MCT oil?
Only when we went to Austin. That was the only time.
Remember I was vomiting? It made me go poo instantly.
Yeah. But it's interesting with the dog talk because I think it's a big talk because
it's important.
People make dogs part of their family, but then don't feed them right. That's kind of interesting. And then they don't live long enough. And then they're sad and depressed because they lost like a family member.
And it's so true. And I'm like you said, you and I off air before we brought Dom on, we were kind of, brainstorming on, our individual research, our due diligence, which we always do. And I wasn't sure how we were going to get that in there, but it was brought up and it is important. I know you don't have, not yet, maybe one day. You'll buy one, but I had,
I've seen it with my parents always had dogs and I've seen it what happens when they die.
Yeah, it's an emotional attachment. Like Peanut, I bought a Lhasa Apso when she was 8 weeks old. She was a little baby. It was it was probably the first thing I ever loved, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And to hear that when dogs get sick, that there are options. I mean, with something as simple as your everyday food that you give them. And he's done a lot of research and also that website, guys, I know we have, a lot of animal lovers on the show just because of my friends and family who listen to yours as well.
Yeah.
Go to that website, and specifically if you want to do more. I know I've already been on the website. You can donate to the research. So, last thing you want to do is see, like, buy from a breeder. You know what I'm saying? When they're kill shelters, it has to happen. It's good to see that there is research to prolong, sick dogs. It's interesting, right?
Dogs ate really well.
Right? You said that too off air. Like, you were like, I have some friends who feed their dogs better than themselves. And that was before we went on.
It's true, man.
And who would have thought the conversation with NASA researcher and ketogenic doctor Dom DiAgostino would turn into a dog lover's bit? Which
No, it's good. It's something kind of unique and something we don't talk about. It's part of everyone's everyday life. So maybe a little bit more information in that regards is something that can help everyone.
And our mutual friend and colleague and buddy, Angus Bradley, we brought up earlier, he hosts a nice little show on iTunes, the High Performance Podcast. He has one of the oldest pugs in the world.
19
years old.
Yeah. 22 is the record, right?
22, man. We got to push.
We got to get him on this diet.
Yeah, so we got to. That's right, man. And we have to, I'm going to see him later. I'm going to tell him about it because he probably had no idea.
Guinness Book of Records, wasn't it?
Close, man. Well, my dog was a Lhasa Apso, and when I bought her, I initially looked at the longest living Lhasa.
Yeah.
32.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's the oldest dog ever in the world?
I wish I had that answer.
I'll just Google it right now.
See, we need a young Jamie for this scenario, but you figure, like you said, the emotional attachment.
Take a punt. You're a punter.
Okay. Longest living dog, I'm going to say 33. It has to be a small breed. I'm going to guess
I'm going to say 41.
Oh, please be 41. I'm going to say a Lhasa from Tibet.
World's oldest dog dies peacefully at age 30.
30. What breed was it?
It was Australian Kelpie.
Wow. Is that closer? Is there a photo of it? Does it look like a wolf?
Yeah. Give me 1 second.
Does it look like a dingo?
I don't know. Louis. Oh, wait. Bluey lived to 29, and he was a cattle dog.
Wow, Bluey. 29 is awesome.
That's pretty good.
That's amazing. Yeah, so I wonder if he would have been on keto if he would have lived longer.
So what are they? You literally times three for a
Well, I heard four. The equation goes, for the first few years of a dog's life, it's normal. I think it's like the first two, it's normal to human. And then every year after, like, there's a window. After its second year, you times it by a certain number.
Have to be like 7 or 8 then.
Something like that. Because the progression of aging, the aging process speeds up from its times it's a puppy. After it gets out of the puppy stage, then each year is like equivalent to, like you said, either 2 or 3 human years.
That's crazy.
But, it's interesting how we've been able to evolve as humans to fill in that void emotionally when humans can't give it to us, we have pets like that, how we domesticated the wolf. Did you ever read or research how we domesticated the wolf?
No.
So when we were hunters and gatherers and we were living in the tribe, and the picture, imagine like, you know, a starry night, the moon is out, you got your little tribe, maybe like 20 people, you got the fire lit. When this fire would be lit and everybody's doing their communal thing, whether you're eating or singing or dancing, whatever it is under the stars, the wolves would come in. And to get the wolf away, because it was a predator, we would take rocks and sticks and throw them at the wolf to get out. And then over time, over this pattern of years and years and years, the wolf would keep coming back. And that's how it would,
and that's how it
ended up becoming domesticated. Now, this is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah,
it's that whole Pavlovian classical conditioning with the bell, the response of an action behavior then becomes a pattern of behavior. But yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Oh, it's very interesting. I heard Dragon talk once a few on a podcast about foxes and rats or something.
I was just listening. Are you talking about how in Australia it's
how
a huge issue?
How it controls the rats or something.
I can't
remember the conversation, but I knew something about controlling rats with foxes, and people don't realize how many foxes or something there are within a capital city, so a downtown part of
Or even wolves. In America, maybe a wolf. It's the wolf. The wolf is in every state.
I think we're foxes.
Yeah, and up until the 1930s, they eradicated the wolves in Yellowstone National Park, and then they started bringing them back. They started introducing the wolf, and then what they started seeing happening is when they tried to eradicate it again, the wolf would send this mating call out, and then the other wolves in the area would hear that call, and then it would make the litters be bigger. It would literally, they have a thing in their evolution, a trait of when they feel danger or they feel predators amongst them, the females who are pregnant will have more pups.
Cool.
It's pretty crazy. Yeah. There's a,
they ain't never going to die then.
No, they're in every state except Hawaii. And talking about Australia, there's a really big wild cat problem in Australia. And
yes.
Did you know about this?
Yes.
Because of
everywhere, man.
Yeah, because I guess about 50 years ago, Australia introduced some animals. There weren't any. The only predators in Australia became extinct. It was the Tasmanian tiger, and then there was a croc. But obviously, the croc is more of a amphibious creature. It's not going to be a predator too much at the mass numbers to animals on land. But when they reintroduced the fox and they reintroduced the cat ended up started eating the ground nesting birds and all the rabbits and all these other animals. And currently in Australia, there's like a list of over 100 animals at risk of going extinct because of these cats. So in some parts of the country, they have people hired to hunt them. So these Americans, these social justice warriors are given – there's one specific Aussie who's on the front line of this – because he's he's preserving the environment and the ecosystem. So on his Instagram, I'll get his name, I'll put it in the notes. He put this photo up of like him hunting cats, and these Americans, these SJW social justice warriors gave him hell because obviously they didn't research and they just see a guy with, looks like a house cat because that's all they look like house cats.
It is a bit of a weird species. Like some of them get, I know a couple of my mates.
They're apex predators, dude.
And they like live in the house better than they do.
Dude.
And then you go see cats near the train station or the bus stop and they're just street cats.
I don't like cats, dude. They are apex predators. A cat, guys, you cat lovers out there, if that cat was your size, it would have eaten you by now. Those things they do is hunt, and they hunt really well. And just because they're nice to you, just because they're
strange.
Small.
Some of them are friends with dogs and mice, and then some of them hate them. And
they're monsters.
They're like, weird.
How about this? If we had to equate the cat to the dog, both in the domesticated format, and then equate those to what they were in the wild at their largest species, the cat versus the dog domesticated, you would think a Rottweiler would destroy any sort of domesticated cat in the domesticated scene. But if you take the wolf, that will say the highest evolved wolf in North America versus the highest evolved cat, which is in probably Africa, which is either the lion or the tiger and lion is going to destroy that wolf.
Hmm.
You know, but in the domesticated scene, it's kind of flip-flopped.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
We need to get some like
cat expert
or that hunter. You know, we got to send that email. A really famous hunter. I don't want to name drop.
Guys, thanks for tuning in today. Got some great episodes coming up. We've got Boost Juice founder and CEO Janice Ellis coming up. Also, All Black strength and conditioning coach Nick Gill. So
I'm excited for that one, man. That's a surprise to me. The Nick Gill one. I thought that was going on the other side.
Definitely, it'll be a great episode. I think everyone will get. Definitely a lot of perspective. Greatest pretty much franchise in the history of the world. So
Americans, that when TK told me that initially, I had to Google it, but he's right. The most, not Duke basketball.
See, I think that's the biggest thing.
Not the New York Yankees.
I think the biggest thing is they verse They compete world. With some really good teams. So, for example, probably the greatest team of all time would have to be the 92 Dream Team or something like that.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. Hands down. The best team ever put together.
But they just had no competition, so it's hard to measure how really great they were.
And there was no longevity. They only played for, what, 8 weeks? Or no, 5 weeks maybe?
Yeah.
These All Blacks, guys, the U-Americans, we're talking about the New Zealand rugby sevens?
No,
15s. So the 15s.
So where they've won, what, the last two World Cups. When you have a look at their record against great teams like Australia, South Africa, England.
This is your ballpark here. Yeah. Keep going. I was going to say another country, but
probably over the last 15 years, the most dominant sporting team of all time across any sport.
Domination in terms of wins, losses, the opponents even putting a fight. Yeah. What's that document?
I think their kind of win record is something like, it would have to be in the high 90s.
Yeah, percentage-wise.
Yeah.
For an overall, that's ridiculous. You don't see that in any other sport.
Especially in a physical combat sport.
In a team sport, too.
And how kind of...
Isn't there a documentary about this?
There should be. There is like, well, they've had a big changing of the guard because a lot of their senior players have retired. So they're all kind of doing like little movie, documentary type sort of thing. There's a guy called Richie McCaw. And then there's Dan Carter as well.
So who would you say is kind of like the... You guys here in Australia call him... Legends when they retire. We call them Hall of Famers in America.
In Australia?
Or like on that all black team, who is like the Michael Jordan over the last 15 years?
Those two guys. Richie McCaw, Dan Carter. There's a whole heap of them. Like they just had so much depth because in New Zealand, in the school system, it's like the equivalent of you guys playing football. Okay. So it's kind of like bred into them.
I think the big difference with the New Zealanders, though, is that rich tradition. When you add in the haka dance and you add in the winning element and the warrior spirit, it was only a few hundred years ago, these guys, their epigenetics, correct me if I'm wrong, TK, were cannibals. Is this true?
I think that's more Samoa or Tonga.
Okay.
But that's kind of like the Polynesian area. But I think the biggest factor in why they're the greatest sporting team of all time is the fact that their population is only 4 million.
And that's why they're the greatest. Wow. Because somebody would argue, well, because it's so small, wouldn't they be limited in terms of the talent pool?
Nah, but they play professionally across cricket, soccer, rugby league.
So how in a small capital like that, that they produce such a powerhouse?
It's the schooling system.
And is that sport from New Zealand?
Bred through them, yeah. It's just because it's just their national sport. It's just like your version. It'll be like
did it start in
Texas
New Zealand?
Or Ohio football. It'll be like that.
Did rugby start in New Zealand?
No. It wouldn't have started. It would have started probably somewhere in Europe. I'm pretty sure England.
See, that's crazy, though. That's something no one talks about because that would be then if American football, which did start in Northeast Ohio.
You would have to think that would probably start.
What if there was a team in Japan who came over and dominated?
That would have probably started after Australia. You would have to think Australia got founded before New Zealand did.
You'd have to think so. But I think of New Zealand, that's the first thing that comes to mind is rugby, the All Blacks. That dance, that warrior dance.
It's so unique with that, yeah, like you said, the haka.
Nick Gill, right?
Yeah,
Nick Stoked, Gill. Man.
Yeah, he's been a good pick. He's been the strength and conditioning coach for a while now. So
young kid, old?
He would have to be in his 40s. You wouldn't think a young coach would be involved with him.
Wonder what his trophy case looks like.
You'd have to be massive.
Right?
All those jackets.
Yeah, wow. Man.
All right, Johnny, great episode, buddy. Really enjoyed bringing you something unique and some great chat from Dom there, brother.
Yeah, likewise, bro. It's always a pleasure. 172 in the books.
All right. We'll check you guys next week.
Peace.
Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast, stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
Whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working hard at it. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.